This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. And you know, when I was asked to fill in for Jane while she takes some much-deserved time off, I was thrilled to hear about today's show topic because I love a good TV show and can talk about riveting television drama until the cows come home. But my enthusiasm was curbed somewhat when I realized that today's show was well-timed to follow last night's series finale of Mad Men, a program that I, along with many other Americans, have been loyally tuning into since the start of its groundbreaking 7-year run. So what's the problem? Well, I may not be alone in this, but given my early morning schedule, the 10 p.m. start time for Mad Men has meant that I tape the show and watch it the following day. And while it's not as difficult as avoiding news of a Game 7 World Series outcome, let's say, I have had to close my ears on a number of occasions already this morning to avoid any mention of the fate the show's writers left to advertising executive Don Draper. Which is partly why the next clip you'll hear, to provide an example of how binge-watching TV has become part of our collective cultural landscape, is not from Mad Men, but from a quirky comedy that pokes fun of a progressive community in Oregon known as Portlandia.
I have to get up early for work, so let's get in our PJs and then we'll watch one more.
Okay, one more.
So good. How is it so good?
What time is it?
It's like daylight already. How did that even happen?
We just stayed up all night.
Do you want to watch more?
My vacation day starts now.
So intense.
Oh my God, so good. Okay, let's just watch the first episode of season 2. That's all I want to see.
One more season.
Yeah, okay, thanks. Bye. So I lost my job.
One more episode?
Yeah.
Now, we are not suggesting that you skip work to watch TV, but our guests today have some intriguing theories on how watching the tube these days has changed us and why we're more riveted perhaps than ever before to stories told on television. With me here in our VPR studios in Colchester is Erica Andrus, a UVM senior religion lecturer. Professor Andrus, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And on the line from Middlebury College is Professor of Film and Media Culture Jason Mattel, author of the book Complex TV, The Poetics of Contemporary Television Storytelling. And Professor Mattel, thanks for being with us as well.
Thanks.
Now, we'd love to hear from you as well. What are some of your favorite TV programs? What draws you to them? Do you binge watch a particular show, 2, 3, perhaps even 4 episodes at a time? Has the advent of the DVR made you feel more in control when you watch a program? Or has it made it too tempting to fill in the hours with TV shows when you could be doing something more productive? You can comment on our Facebook page. We've already gotten a lot of comments there. Or give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Professor Andrus, I'd like to start with you, and listeners may be wondering why we have a senior lecturer in religion on with us today to talk about television. What is it about TV these days or the way we watch it that, in your view, intersects with religion?
Well, there's a couple of ways of approaching that question. I teach a course on religion and popular culture, and I also teach a course on religion, film, and television. And so when I approach that with my students, the first thing we look at is kind of the most direct intersection is how does television portray religion? And what does that tell us about how we as Americans feel about religion or perceive religion in society? How does it portray what we feel about other so-called other religions like Buddhism, Islam, Judaism, religions that are not the mainstream Protestant or even Catholic Christianity? But also then we move on and we kind of look at how does television actually take on some of the functions that we normally think of as belonging in the religious sphere. So the creation of kind of alternate realities or whole worlds that are similar to ours, but also different. So the immersion in storytelling and narrative that we find also in mythology and in the narrative parts of religion, and then other aspects like ritual, where we come together as groups of fans of a particular show. And this doesn't happen clearly with every show.
No.
But we have, you know, the classic example is Star Trek, where there's a very active fan community and they've taken it way beyond just the television shows. They put on the outfits, they learn the languages, they come together in communities and groups and they do good things. And it also really informs their worldview, what they think is right and wrong. They use at least analogies from Star Trek, if not the actual philosophies that are presented to them in the Star Trek world. So all of these things create a very rich area of looking at how we, in a society where people are claiming less and less of a religious affiliation or identity, express these same aspects of our lives that used to be mostly found naturally in a religious setting.
So the TV is taking on some of those aspects in a way. Professor Mattel, is television as a medium more or less dominant in the culture now than it was when there were only three major TV networks and fewer viewing choices, but there were more people watching the same things at the same time?
Yeah, I think it's differently dominant. So back in the classic network era, sort of pre-90s, you had the vast majority of the population watching television, but you had them watching the same things, as you suggested. So it wasn't uncommon to get 30, 40 million people watching the same episode in a given night. We are much more dispersed, but television and television-like entertainment, I think, is actually more central to our culture today, at least central to the culture of storytelling. I think that in the 70s, for instance, a lot of television was very influential, but there wasn't a sense that if you wanted to see great storytelling, you would go to television. Television was seen as either something that was escapist or maybe that bonded us together as a nation. But if you wanted artful, creative work, you tended to go to film. And I think that has certainly shifted quite a bit. The box office is the place where you can have everyone goes to see the same thing. Everyone went to see The Avengers or Mad Max. But with television, a lot of different people are watching different things, but they're much more immersive and central to people's lives in the way of religiosity, the way that Erica described.
Yeah, I'm interested in that kind of immersion. And Professor Andrus, I think some people might say that binge watching, which has become a real thing of a certain show, takes on a kind of religious devotion to the material. I'm guessing you would disagree with that view.
Slightly. I think part of what Jason was just mentioning, this aspect that in the past, everyone was kind of aligned together. You could only watch the show when the network decided you could watch the show. So in some ways, that gave television a more ritualistic setting. You know, you had to tune in at
the same time. Showing up for church on Sunday, that's when the Mass is going to be. This
exactly.
is when you show up to watch MASH, let's say.
Exactly. And the canon, if you want to speak in those terms of fandom, you know, was much more specific. It was only what was aired on the networks, whereas now these boundaries are breaking down. And in fact, there's almost a more kind of interactive aspect to it. And as I was thinking about coming here today and talking to you, I kind of thought, well, there's almost an analogy between what happened with cable and then the internet to the Protestant Reformation, where suddenly instead of all of the authority being vested in the institution, there's this at least appearance of democratization and spreading of the technology so that now people can make their own fan shows, or they can take clips from their favorite show and set it to music and put that out on YouTube and everybody can see it, and then they become part of this dialogue. So you can interpret the text, if you're calling the TV show the text, for yourself, the way that Protestants felt like they could interpret the Bible for themselves without the priest coming in between them and the Word of God.
Taking a little more control, in a sense, of what they are devoted to. I mean, we see that too with, you know, there were fans of the television show Veronica Mars, and when the show ended, it was canceled. They didn't take that, you know, sitting down, they started one of those Kickstarter campaigns and funded a new movie themselves just by taking control of that and getting it onto the screens. It's quite remarkable. We're talking about religion and television, and we have Professor Erica Andrus with us today, also Jason Mattel from Middlebury College. And I'm sorry to have cut you off there, Professor Mattel. You wanted to add on to that.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in. I think that the Veronica Mars example is a good one. it is true that Veronica Mars allowed for a type of fan participation and through funding got the movie to, well, got the series to come back as a movie. But I think that a lot of what was happening around Veronica Mars and a lot of the programs that certainly I've written about and I think that Erica's talking about is a reassertion of a central author figure. So in television, there is the figure of the showrunner. And one of the hallmarks of contemporary television is that showrunners are celebrities in and of themselves. So with Veronica Mars, it was Rob Thomas, the creator of the show, who actually launched the Kickstarter. And his fan persona and the fact that he had a very active Twitter account and a lot of people who were following his work, that got fans to rally around that program and then fund the film. And I think we can see that authorial function as serving an almost religious role. So while I agree that fans produce their own work and transform the text, there are a lot of fans who see their devotion to the text as tied to this creator figure. And so obviously there are these religious connotations where their job is to say, I want to see whatever it is that David Simon or Aaron Sorkin, or in the case of Mad Men, Matt Weiner, is going to tell me. And there's a real sense of devotion and affirmation there.
Yeah, and I think that viewers are more savvy about who is behind these programs than they ever were before. Dan Harmon is another example of a showrunner who's had a contentious relationship with the program, the network that ran Community before it was canceled a number of times. Now it's back on Yahoo for streaming viewing, and certainly fans were ready to get behind him. They felt that he was the heart and soul of that particular show. We're talking about television and its intersection with religion and how you watch TV. You can call us at 1-800-639-2211, or you can write to us on our Facebook page. We have a number of folks who've written in already, and we heard this from Paul, who said, last night a major network played a colorized version of I Love Lucy during prime time. It reminded him of simpler times when Comedy Says didn't have to be crude, crass, or vulgar to succeed. In the case of MASH, the dialogue was quick and witty while still addressing political issues of the time. And I think that with some exceptions, he says, like The Big Bang Theory, he believes television content has regressed in many ways. Perhaps that's a view that you share as well. Let us know about it. Call it 1-800-639-2211. And Professor Andrus, you often lecture about how religion is depicted on television. You were saying that's one of the big things you talk about. Is that a mostly positive or negative portrayal?
Well, of course, it really depends on the religion that you're talking about. In American popular culture in general, we tend to have the view that Islam is not a good religion, right?
Shows like 24, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mostly parts for Muslims in television shows tend to be the terrorist part. Whereas you see the opposite with Buddhism, right? Or Eastern religions in general. Sometimes it's not even identified as Buddhism. Sometimes it's just kind of a generic, stereotyped Eastern religion that is portrayed as peaceful and wise. So there do tend to be these stereotypes that are problematic when it comes to the portrayal of religion. But also some scholars have written about how people who are atheists are also given a bad rap on TV. So you have figures like House or Bones who are atheists and they are sort of maladjusted, right? They have mental illness issues. And so their religious persona is tied up in their mental health issues. So it's not just a matter of being religious, but, and then of course there's also, if you're too religious as even as a Christian, that's sort of untrustworthy or negative.
Well, that's one of the things I'm curious about, because one of my favorite shows over the years has been The Simpsons. And I think that they have been one of the most interesting shows to watch, even though you don't think of it as a serious program. They really delve into religion, I think, in a very serious way. And what about the portrayal of Christianity? Because I remember one particular episode where Homer becomes super smart after having a crayon that was touching his brain extracted from his nose. That's the only reason he could become smart. And he says that while he was working on a flat tax proposal, he accidentally proved there was no God. And he tells this to Ned Flanders, who's the resonant, very religious character. And then Ned Flanders goes on to destroy the evidence. He says, oh, we can't let this be getting out. But at the same time, there are very sympathetic portrayals of Christianity through Reverend Lovejoy and some of the other characters on the show. Is this a show that you discuss with your class when it comes to talking about Christianity?
Oh, sure. We talk about it when we talk about satire as a genre of television. And yeah, I think it's The Simpsons is a great example of a show that is affectionately satirical. So they poke fun at – I mean, Reverend Lovejoy is not somebody you want to be.
No, right? Necessarily.
They don't give him a lot of respect. But in the other characters' interactions with him, the other characters then come to kind of stand for a more humane Christianity or a more meaningful Christianity, even though he kind of is the foil as the hypocritical minister who doesn't really care about God or his flock. But at the same time, then the other characters kind of push back against that and end up reinforcing a deeper kind of message. So, yeah, I agree. The Simpsons really does have a lot to tell us.
Professor Mattel, I wonder about the phrase binge watching, which we talked about at the top. And, you know, it seems troubling in that we associate that word with destructive behavior, drinking, overeating. Do you think it's taken that way in the context of television watching, or do we give it a pass when we talk about TV? I mean, people come and say, oh, I was binge watching Breaking Bad. You know, it took hours out of my time. But they're never going to come in and admit that they were binging on the kind of drug that Walter White used to cook up on that show.
Yeah, the phrase binge watching is one I actually try to avoid. I tend to talk about compressed viewing, the idea that you're watching a bunch of episodes in as, you know, quick a succession as you can reasonably do. And I think that it's interesting. I think that binge watching has a lot of people talk about it as if this is the new norm. This is how everyone does it. The little bits of data that is out, because Netflix actually doesn't share any of its viewer data, but based on what I've read, it actually is not a norm. It is actually more of a fringe practice, but it's a very vocal fringe practice. And I think most people do a mix. So there may be certain shows that you watch in quick succession via compression, and then the vast majority of shows you watch more doled out over time. I think what it speaks to is the idea that it used to be that television was completely scheduled for us and that we didn't have any control or agency over how we watched television. The VCR changed that a little bit, but the vast majority of people never figured out how to program their VCR to actually record it. And then DVRs allowed more active time shifting. And now the rise of streaming services like Netflix, or even before that, TV on DVD, have allowed people to take more control of the time in the same way that people can take control of how they read a book. Some people read two or three books at the same time in alternation. Some, you pick up a book and you don't read anything else until you finish that book, and you have the sense of you read it in quick succession. One of the really important things to think about when talking about television viewing is that it is part of everyday life, and people's lives are very different. There are many people who can't afford to participate in services like Netflix or Hulu to so-called binge watch. There are a lot of people who can't afford the time, and I speak of people with young children. The idea that you could carve out, you know, 5 or 6 hours to marathon a show is certainly not part of my own lifestyle, even though watching television is something that I do for work as well as for pleasure.
We're talking about television, the way it's changed us, the way it may change us in the future, and we'll have you join the conversation. Call us at 1-800-639-2211. We'll be right back after this break. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. And today on the program, we're talking about television and the way it's changing our viewing habits and perhaps us as a society as well. We're joined by Erica Andrus, UVM Senior Religion Lecturer, and Jason Mattel, Professor of Film and Media Culture at Middlebury College. And you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or write to us on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Has TV changed for the better in the past 20 years? Is the writing more sophisticated, the characters more complex, or do you long for the days of old-fashioned television? 1-800-639-2211. We've got some comments that we've heard from folks on Facebook and, of course, overheard in the VPR newsroom today as well. We're not going to say who said these things. Quote, I had a lost weekend with the West Wing. Don't know how it happened. I think I blacked out. After getting my wisdom teeth removed in 2009, I watched 3 seasons of Lie to Me. Then I had to wait for the drugs to wear off so I could drive to the video store to rent more DVDs. And someone else right here in VPR said, I watched hours of Little House on the Prairie while painting my living room. Bad stuff happened on the prairie. There's no question about that. And we are joined now by Erica Andrus, UVM Senior Religion Lecturer, and Jason Mattel of Middlebury College. And Erica, I want to ask if there's a tendency among academics, perhaps, to dismiss religion in some ways, while at the same time giving credit to TV writers and producers for helping us make these emotional connections with characters. I mean, a lot of people, as Jason Mattel was talking about before, really, you know, get into these characters and care so much about them. But those characters, of course, are not real.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the insights that I had while I was actually doing a little research on an online community that was sort of focused on a particular character from the show Battlestar Galactica, is that when we watch television, it's not just that we see these same characters, you know, every week or every night if we are watching it, you know, streaming or whatever, but we also see them in a much more intimate way than we see actual people. So, for example, on that show, the very first episode, you meet one of the main characters while she's in the doctor's office and she receives a diagnosis of cancer. Hmm. And so that's a moment that most people don't share with a friend or an acquaintance, certainly. And then later in that same episode, there's a very moving scene where she is the only one that knows that she's sick. And she's on a spaceship, which is more like an airplane in the setting of the show. And she's just overwhelmed with the emotion of having received this diagnosis. And she runs into the bathroom to put water on her face. And, you know, you see her in this very intimate moment that not even anyone in that character's life is with her at that moment. So nobody knows her as well as we who are sitting in our living room experiencing this with her through the screen. Mm-hmm. So television really does pull on your emotions in a way that is quite intimate. And to me, that kind of explains why we develop these intense, what psychologists call parasocial relationships with television characters, because it's meant to do that. It's the kind of storytelling that is trying to evoke emotions for you. So you feel these emotions, and even though the person isn't real, the experience of the emotion is also real.
So you're having a relationship with that character the way maybe some people say they have a relationship with God. I mean, they feel like they know this person, this entity. It's part of their lives.
Yeah, and that's sort of one of the interesting questions to me as a scholar and also as a person is, why is it that we are very careful and adamant about this distinction we make between made-up stories on television and real stories that are from religions, right? And I'm not going to say that there's not a difference, but I'm just interested in exploring what that difference is.
Right. Professor Mattel, one of the things that I've found that's good about TV and the way it's changed over the last 20 years can be found in a show like The Wire, which I'm going to go ahead and say it, I think is the greatest thing that's ever been put on television. I think that the showrunner, you mentioned his name before, David Simon, one of the things that he refused to do on that show, and it was so different, it took me a while to get used to, was he just completely refused to have any exposition whatsoever. In other words, most television shows that are a series, you know, you'll have a character come in and say, my gosh, that's Bobby. Oh, and then someone else will say, Bobby, you mean the man who stole your dog back in 1992? Yeah, that Bobby. You know, and they're spelling things out for the viewer, whereas The Wire refused to do that. You could watch, and it was up to you to make the connections between what character was doing what, There were many, many characters involved, a lot of different storylines, and he completely left it up to the viewer. Do you think that's a more positive change in television that makes it a little more like, say, a novel or a more sophisticated type of entertainment?
I would say it's a different type of entertainment. I really don't like saying, oh, contemporary television is more novelistic, because what it does is it basically says that television is aspiring to this older medium. I think what television does today and has always done is unique to the medium, and we should take it on its own terms. That being said, I think that The Wire is a great example of what I call complex television, in that it does not ask you to follow things as they're handed to you, as you suggested. It does not expect that you can miss an episode and figure out what's going on. It throws you into a situation. It can be a, you know, seemingly realistic situation like on The Wire, or it could be fantastic like on Battlestar Galactica. But the idea is that the relationships between the characters, who they are, what they do, this world that is being built will not be spelled out for you. You will experience it over episode after episode. And that sense of engagement in a world that is not clear to you at first glance is something that I think is unique to television, especially in its serial form. The idea that you watch an episode and then you have to wait a week in order to go back to that world, in order to re-experience those relationships, is really important, I think, to the power of television and that ritual effect where we keep going back because we want to have that bond. We want to be confused and have that sense of, wait, who is this character and how did they relate? And part of what's happening today is because the internet is a sort of always present second screen, a lot of television writers and producers have embraced this, not necessarily to say, hey, fans, make your own fan fiction or fan videos, but to say, document this stuff so, as a reference point, so we don't have to spell it out for you. They've outsourced the exposition, and they've outsourced a lot of the sort of confusion and taking care of that confusion to fans to create their wikis, to create their fan sites, so that you don't have to spend time in an episode itself reminding us of what's going on. And I think that that is becoming really baked into how television producers see their audience, as always able to look something up so that we don't have to tell it for you.
Warren is on the line from Stockbridge. Hi, Warren.
Hi there.
Thanks for being with us.
Sure thing. I'm a retired magazine publisher from Boston, and in 1950, the dawn of the TV age, the president of Boston University, James Marsh, made headlines, national headlines, for an op-ed piece he wrote, predicting that television would turn Americans into morons. I was using the word moron in the clinical sense, you know, the original clinical sense, which meant somebody whose mental functioning was so low that they had to be supervised. What I find fascinating, you know, I'm the first generation of TV watchers, is that the big effect of television is that it is, no question about it, an opinion shaper, but it is viewed by a critical mass of people as inerrant. You remember that whole thing of the fundamentalists, you know, the Bible is inerrant. Well, there are many people today who watch TV who get their opinions from TV, and you can't convince them otherwise, and they've lost their ability, Americans, I think, to reason. In other words, it's like the Pope has just issued a bull, and the Catholics, all of them just sort of fall in line.
Well, Warren, let me stop you for a minute and ask just quickly, are you talking more about news-oriented programs where people form their opinions, or are you saying that they're getting their opinions, you know, from fictional TV shows like Mad Men or Breaking Bad, that kind of thing?
Both.
Interesting.
That's the thing.
Well, let's let our guests react to that, because it's a very interesting point. And there are a lot of people certainly over the years who have said that, you know, they call television the boob tube and have not had very good things to say about it. Professor Mattel, what do you think about Warren's thoughts there about television and what it's doing to folks' brains?
I don't like to think of television as doing things to people. I like to think about what people do with television. And there's no doubt that television shapes our opinions. It shapes our perspective on the world. Like Erica was saying, it provides access to moments. If you're talking about fiction, any character, or if you're talking about nonfiction, to sort of real life that you would have no way to see or experience. That being said, just because you see it, you don't assume, and I don't think that the majority of viewers do assume, that it is simply truth. I think one of the best sort of phrases about this is that media, or television specifically, don't tell people what to think. They tell people what to think about. So I think that there's no doubt that the media shapes our perspectives, and they give us a vocabulary, a repertoire of the world, but they do not brainwash us. And if anything, I would say that, you know, every medium, whether it's books or magazines or television or public radio, helps shape our perspective on the world, and then it's up to us to figure out how we integrate that into our own opinions.
Erica Andrus, go ahead.
And I just would like to say also that this is true in religion as well. The Pope may issue all the encyclicals and bulls that he wants, and he does, but not all Catholics just immediately jump on board. So, you know, religion, too, is complex. And I think that both religion and television do get oversimplified in the narrative like that sometimes.
Erica, we had a caller from Springfield, Ethan, who wants to know if you are familiar with an Irish program called Father Ted. He said he's watched a few episodes of this and wanted to ask how you felt the show handled satire, if you're familiar with it.
Oh, unfortunately, I've heard of it, but I've never seen
it. Let's get another call in. Ken is on the line from Burlington. Hi, Ken.
Oh, how you doing? Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
It was interesting, a lot of things you're saying. I was calling about something else, but I just quickly wanted to say that I don't think that analyzing television in such a way that it's this new groundbreaking way that we can sort of experience life, I don't think that's happening. I think that just television has gotten better, and it, like you said at the beginning, it's more akin to what film used to be. But the comment I wanted to make was, and to see if any of the listeners have experienced this, I watch the great shows. I love The Wire. I love Game of Thrones, Six Feet Under. But I also have to admit that I'm addicted to reading the Huffington Post. And unfortunately, the Huffington Post, I can't go on the main page without them spoiling something for me. So they have these TV writers, and it's just like, you'll never believe who died in Game of Thrones this week. And then there's a picture. And so I can't even open up the Huffington Post anymore without it.
This is a common
ruining some of my favorite shows.
It's a common problem, Ken. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to cut you off there because we're running out of time. But absolutely, I think that a lot of folks have had that problem. And I have had to go out of my way just today, for example, to not find out anything about the Mad Men finale last night. Twitter, all that. I'm just trying to avoid it all because it does get saturated too much. And it happens all the time. I want to thank our guests very much. We've run out of time, unfortunately. Erica Andrus, Senior Religion Lecturer at the University of Vermont, and Jason Mattel, Professor of Film and Media Culture at Middlebury College. Thank you both so much for speaking with us today.
Well, thank you for having us. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Mitch.
And coming up, VPR's Steve Zind on how likely is a sale of Fairpoint Communications. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. There have long been rumblings of a possible sale of Fairpoint Communications, Vermont's primary telephone and internet service provider. Last week, speculation was heightened when Fairpoint's CEO, Paul Sanu, told investors and industry analysts that the company, quote, must consider mergers and acquisitions as either a seller or a buyer as part of our overall strategy. Well, here to tell us about the prospects for a Fairpoint sale is VPR's Steve Zind. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Mitch.
Now, if there's long been talk of a possible Fairpoint sale, is there anything that makes that possibility more likely now than in the past?
Well, yeah, you could argue the stars are better aligned now, Mitch, than they have been in the past. And a lot of that has to do with the settlement that Fairpoint reached earlier this year with the striking union workers, which ended a period of uncertainty. But more importantly, for the company at least, under the new contract, the company is saving $680 million just in pension costs, costs and other obligations to retirees. Now, union workers don't see that as good, but it does make Fairpoint more attractive to prospective buyers.
Well, the exodus of landline telephone customers to wireless cable companies has been pretty well documented, and Fairpoint has lost significant telephone business to companies like Verizon, Comcast, AT&T, and it's been losing money quarter after quarter. So why would the company be attractive to a potential buyer now?
Well, you're right. Fairpoint has a net loss of more than $45 million in the first quarter of the current fiscal year. And when we look at the entire 2014 fiscal year, they had a net loss of something like $136 million. So big losses. And a big part of that problem is the loss of landline telephone customers. The state issued an estimate at one point last year that Fairpoint had lost about a third of its landline customers between 2007 and 2011. And I saw a document recently that said the losses have been even greater in Massachusetts and Maine. So in response to that, the company's been trying to rebrand itself, Mitch, as kind of a technology telecommunications service, get away from this idea of Fairpoint being a phone company. And that side of the business is growing. The problem is it's just not growing fast enough to offset the loss of other business. But it's that side, the technology telecommunications side, that is attractive to potential buyers.
Well, other than residential telephone and broadband service, where is Fairpoint's business coming from?
Well, that's what they call their enterprise business. So we're talking about big customers like hospitals, like banks, like state governments. You know, Fairpoint has the contract for the E911 services in Vermont and Maine, also has state contract in New Hampshire for telecom services. And ironically, Mitch, the wireless companies that are siphoning away Fairpoint's residential phone customers are also providing it with revenue, because Fairpoint's the one running fiber to cell towers that the wireless companies are using. And in doing that and building out their fiber network, they've now got something like 18,000 miles of fiber across northern New England to service those big customers and to help out with some of its residential broadband service. An industry analyst told me that fiber is, quote, the crown jewel of Fairpoint, and that's what buyers are really interested in. On the other hand, and this is worth pointing out too, and I'm sure a buyer will take this into account, Fairpoint's telephone infrastructure is really old. There was some expert testimony offered during the current Public Service Board hearing, which is about Fairpoint service quality problems. And he said, quote, the vast majority of its plant is beyond its depreciation lifespan, and Fairpoint is making no effort to modernize it, unquote. So you've got this modern fiber and this old copper.
And isn't part of the problem, too, reputation here? Because Fairpoint purchased its landline phone business from Verizon back in 2007, and the company's entrance into Vermont was, let's say, fraught with problems, that might be putting it mildly, right from the get-go. Remind us of some of the history there.
Yeah, remember, that was sort of likened to a minnow swallowing a whale. Little Fairpoint at the time buying up this big Verizon landline business, and there were a lot of concerns raised about that, whether Fairpoint had the financial wherewithal to handle it. And it turns out the concerns were somewhat justified, because Fairpoint filed for bankruptcy about 18 months after it took on the Verizon system. And then you remember there was all those billing problems trying to transfer the system from Verizon to Fairpoint, raised the ire of a lot of customers and of regulators. And of course, there have been the ongoing service quality problems, which we've heard about, which have led to the investigation by the Public Service Board, which is underway now. Now, in all fairness, many of the problems have been straightened out or stabilized, but the experience has really tarnished Fairpoint's reputation among many consumers and raised concerns about the company's reliability in the future.
Well, if Fairpoint, Steve, is indeed sold, who are the most likely buyers at this point?
I should point out, Mitch, that Fairpoint is a relatively small company, so there isn't a lot of expertise, a lot of analysts out there watching it. But I talked to Barry Sine of the Wall Street financial firm Drexel Hamilton. And for his money, Frontier Communications, which is based in Connecticut, is the most likely buyer. They operate in more than two dozen states, and they've been buying up AT&T and Verizon landline business in a number of states. So it kind of fits with their plan. And they're also nearby in another New England state. So in his mind, it makes sense. The other thing is Frontier is much larger than Fairpoint. Fairpoint has about 3,000 employees. Frontier has something like 17,000. There are a couple of other companies Sine mentioned. Foremost among them is probably CenturyLink. Of course, Fairpoint and its shareholders would be very interested in having a bidding war between between a couple of companies to just increase the price that they might get for the company. But at least this point, it seems that Frontier is the one in the best position to take on Fairpoint.
Of course, the big question, Steve, and it may be a bit of speculation here, but would the sale of Fairpoint, if it happens, be good news for Vermonters?
Well, Mitch, all of this is speculation, and we should underscore that. The talk of a sale, we have no reason to believe that there are any negotiations underway. This is something that's been talked about for quite a while, as you mentioned at the outset. I think what made it more real, perhaps, was it's the first time I can recall Paul Sinu mentioning it in a quarterly earnings report, as he did a couple of weeks ago. So there may or may not be a sale. But it's important to note that many of Fairpoint's largest shareholders are hedge funds, and they bought in when the company went bankrupt. They are not telecom companies. They're in the business of getting a return on their investment, and their plan has always been to sell the company and get that return. As for the question you asked, will it be good news for Vermonters? The Public Service Board will have to make that decision because they're the ones that are going to have to approve any sale. I think if Frontier were the buyer, many people might see that as positive because, as we pointed out, it's a company with more resources than Fairpoint has. It seems to have a good track record where it's gone in and purchased landline operations. It did so in West Virginia, where it bought Verizon's assets and turned around a situation that had been fraught with ongoing service problems, and now apparently Frontier gets pretty good marks for the service being provided. So all that said, if there is any sale of Fairpoint, that could still be years away, and we'll just have to see what happens.
That's VPR Steve Zind, who's been covering the news that Fairpoint may be looking to offload its landline telephone business in Vermont, and you can follow updates on that reporting at vpr.net. Steve, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Mitch.
And now we turn to your comments to Vermont Edition, and managing producer Patty Daniels is with me in the talk studio. Hi, Patty, and what's first?
Hi, Mitch. First are pigs. We spoke with Virgin's food writer Barry Estabrook about his new book, Pig Tales, in which he looks at the practices of large pork producers.
And Eli posted on Facebook, "My wife and I have been researching raising pigs on our property. Prior to researching this, I had no idea that pigs were raised on pasture in an environment much like cattle. We have been in touch with Walter Jeffries at Sugar Mountain Farm, and he has a great operation there. He's one of the many Vermonters raising pigs well."
And Diana in Woodstock gave a shout out to another local farmer. She writes, "Springmore Farm in Baltimore, Vermont raises the best pork I have ever had since I was a child. Owner John raises all of his own animals on his farm. I can't wait for farmers markets so I can buy from John. Good pork is more of a treat to me than lobster or steak."
Labrapotes posted this explanation on the difference between white and dark meat. "Dark meat is fast twitch muscles. It's dark because, in effect, they have the hemoglobin built right into the cell, so it can store its own oxygen for rapid access. White meat, like the breasts of chickens, are for endurance use and require a steady flow of oxygen. Legs are dark because they are for fast acceleration. The whiteness is not caused by how the birds are raised."
Okay, and moving on. Last week, VPR's Angela Evansy brought us the story of a farm auctioneer in the 1970s by the name of Willis Hicks. And his portrait is included in a current exhibition at the Shelburne Museum. And Angela's story tracked down a lot of people who remembered him well and also the changing times that he represented.
And Eileen Wheelock wrote in response, "Great story about Willis Hicks. I did know him, and it was a thrill to see the photos of him. I have Peter Miller's book, but I didn't know about the National Geographic article. I'm going over to Burlington this weekend to see the exhibit."
All right. And we also dug into a mountain of data with UVM researchers last week who are studying why people choose to leave, stay, or return to Vermont. And on that conversation, CJ wrote, "Why are politicians all worked up about preventing kids from leaving? It seems selfish, stunting, and unrealistic. Kids should be required to go away, go on a mission. It would give them their freedom and a new view on the Green Mountains." And CJ says, "Homesickness works. I'm a very quick returner, and mud season is one of my five favorite seasons."
And finally, one reaction to our interview with House Speaker Shep Smith. When we spoke to him on Friday, the legislature was still a day away from adjourning, with many tax and budget decisions still to be made. That prompted Joe to write, "Please don't enable our Republican, indeed, governor. cut is how it works or how it doesn't work in Kansas and Wisconsin.
Well, obviously, Governor Peter Shumlin is a Democrat, regardless of the jab from Joe. Governor Shumlin will be our guest on Thursday to look back at the legislative session that began and ended with unusual drama. And first, before that, on Wednesday, we'll give some of the state's top political reporters a crack at encapsulating what lawmakers did in Montpelier this winter. So join us on Wednesday and Thursday for those discussions of the legislative session.
Thanks so much, Patty. But coming up tomorrow, a big new study on the American religious landscape is out, and Vermont has the highest percentage of people identifying as unaffiliated with any religion. We're unpacking that number and looking at the past and future of religion in Vermont. Tell us what you see. Write into Vermont Edition at vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Sangari, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Devin Karambelis and Amanda Shepherd. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Mitch Wertlieb, in for Jane Lindholm, and thanks so much for listening.